Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jayaram.
And you're listening to the Coast to Coast Bio podcast episode number, I think it's 36.
Yeah, I think so too. I think last one was 35. And I think, yeah, we are close to our promise of recording every few weeks. The last one was, what, 3 weeks back or something?
It's been a little longer than that. It's about a month, I think, because we recorded just before Christmas.
Oh, wow. Okay, time flies.
Yeah, time does fly, especially, I think we'd planned to record earlier this month, and as usual, something came up and we couldn't do so. Right. But anyway, all's well that ends well.
Exactly.
Here we are, and technical problems...
As long as
we have no technical problems, we should be fine.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny. I need to really settle down and write this thing down, I guess. You know, like just today I switched from the left-hand side USB port to the right-hand side and everything was totally different. It was almost like I had a new computer or something.
That's why I do everything in templates.
What's a template?
I have like a podcasting template. I don't do anything other than... hit record.
Yeah, but I mean, the template won't tell you to put your USB mic into the right hand side slot and not the left.
No, that I just remembered. and you have a pretty high powered mic, so it probably pulls more power. When you say right hand, so you have a MacBook.
No,
are you recording on a PC or?
No,
or
I always do it on my MacBook. So I thought that.
Oh, you got an older MacBook. So
yeah,
I was like, my MacBook Pro doesn't have anything on the right-hand side.
I know. No, I thought the right-hand sides were the better place because that's where most, like, hard disks would very often not get recognized on the left. But if you put it in the right, it would always work. So I thought that was the better powered one.
Maybe it's putting too much power.
Yeah, you never know. Exactly.
Yeah.
So
it did sound like you had way more gain. There's this, and you were, like, basically overdriving the microphone. Anyway.
Right.
Here we are. Tell me what you've been up to other than work and maybe nothing. And I guess digging out of a lot of snow these days.
Oh my goodness. It's been quite something. But I like it actually. I must say I enjoy the snow thoroughly. Though I don't do any winter sports and stuff. But something about shoveling makes me feel very primally active or whatever. You know, it's like the equivalent of hunting or something.
I shall leave you with your primal instincts. I like snow when it's there for 2 days. Looks good. You can take a lot of pictures after that.
Actually, speaking of taking pictures in the snow, I lost my iPhone doing that. I was like, you didn't catch all that. Actually, I got quite a few condolences from friend feeders.
Was it an iPhone 4 or an older
one? No, the older one. 3GS, okay. Though, not the oldest
one.
It's
not something you had under contract and things like that.
No, I'm still not eligible for an upgrade, so I'm told. But I'm really contemplating the switch to Android. Let's see.
Verizon's coming out. So
yeah.
Are you AT&T or what carrier are you? AT&T?
I'm AT&T, right.
Yeah.
But it was quite hilarious. I like took all these awesome pictures of the snow, one of the big storms we had. And then there was a plow coming. So I like ran from the street and climbed the snowbank. And basically it was still snowing pretty heavily. And next thing I know, I walked a couple of steps and I'm like, all right, let me take another picture. I'm like, wait, where's my camera? And so in a 20-foot radius, I knew where my phone fell, right? Because I had a picture. But after that, I basically haven't found it. I drove back there with my car's Bluetooth to see if it pick it up. It is quite insane. But it's probably buried in the snow. When it all melts, there'll be like a frozen iPhone. So
yeah,
pretty sad.
My indulgence. So hopefully, obviously, do you have a phone at all these days?
Yeah, I resurrected my old Nokia phone. And it really, I feel like I've gone back like 20 years or something. You know, that's when it strikes you. How long did people use this before, the iPhone? I mean, no, I'm just saying, right? The usability.
The iPhone or the Quantum Leap, right?
Exactly. It's one of those things.
But
now I'm just realizing it even more, I mean, I think this thing has T9, but every text message I get, I'm like, okay, I refuse to reply. I can't afford to type for like 10 minutes to get a message across. No. So I just pretty much called them right back.
I used to have one of these Motorola flip phones, right? Before the iPhone came. if I remember. No, I had a Samsung Blackjack.
Yeah.
And which seemed like a leap over having a flip phone, but it was clunky. Well, not that fun to use, but you could get email on it.
It takes me 8 key presses to go from the main screen to my my text messages. And, you know,
see, that's the reason I prefer the iPhone to Android. Android's nice, mm-hmm. but there's two parts that I have never liked about Android, playing around with it. One is it's more menu-driven in some mm-hmm. ways. So that's why most Android phones have 4 buttons, right? Because it make you do a little more clicking. Mm-hmm. The main reason I don't like it, the response of the touchscreen is not as good. And in a pure touchscreen phone, you want good touchscreen response.
Yeah, apparently, actually, I was looking at a phone running Gingerbread, right? Which is a quantum.
Are there any that run Gingerbread these days, other than the Nexus S?
I mean, a buddy of mine has a rooted phone.
He has a rooted phone.
Yeah, he has a rooted phone. So he was running Gingerbread, and he was telling me, it's one of those almost iPad like. What's the big brick phone? I don't know. It's a.
The Droid X.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah,
the Evo, and the Droid X are the two
pretty big guy,
ones,
but he has this big ass phone, and it really seems snappier after he put Gingerbread on it.
Yeah, that's good.
And also, I guess the UI is being made over big time.
Yeah,
the Java Posse guys were. I mean, so I follow that podcast a lot, right? So a lot of them actually moved from. One of them, Tor Norby, he moved into Google, into the Android team. And he went from being like an Android, like, you know, he basically was like, oh, there's no way Android will ever catch up. To now he's at Google now. And he's like, oh, Android's amazing. And he said, I never thought I would say this, but the polish of the UI and Gingerbread and, I mean, everything is coming along.
Because they need that. The challenge, of course, is that there are no phones with Gingerbread out there.
Actually, speaking of all this, do you follow the... there was a challenge, or not a challenge, it was more like, I think Nature and somebody else, I'd like to say, it was a Macmillan thing. They put out a science app, it was kind of a request for science apps, which they would monetize. It is this weird...
So that website, right? That's Timo Hene's new project.
Right. Project. So what is this? Do you know more about it, or...?
I should know more about it, otherwise Caitlin will kill me. That's why she moved to the UK.
Is that Caitlin Thaney or?
Yeah. Oh, so this is why she moved to the UK, is to run business development or whatever for that.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
So basically it's an application platform for science. What's it called?
Right.
I should just assume Macmillan.
All right. I'll let you Google for it.
Applications. I'm Googling as we speak.
Yeah. No, but I saw this and, you know, it was basically like
digital science.
A request for better software on... It seemed to imply it was more for like mobile platforms, but I think it was pretty broad in its scope.
No, I think it's multiple platforms. Correct. Right. So what it is if you look at it, it is... So the goal is to provide software and information to support, and I'm just reading here, researchers and research administrators in their everyday work. So the way they're doing it is it's not quite an app store. It's more like an app platform.
Mm-hmm.
I can think it's a way for people to make applications available to other people, make data available to other people. I think it's still early days. I mean, they just made an announcement with a few partners. So if you look at the products that they advertise, you have something called Symplectic Elements, which is a research management tool. There's a chemical search portal, and there's this laboratory sort of electronic.
What's the project called?
It's called Digital Science.
Okay, I'm just looking
digital.
It up, yeah.
It's digital-science.com, and so the team is. Do you know who Dan Hagen is? He's on FriendFeed. You might have run into him. You have Timo Hene, who is the managing director. You have, who else is there that I might know other than Caitlin? Caitlin's running the external partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
So James Seidel, for some reason that name's familiar. Can't place it. But so that's definitely the idea and et cetera. So if you look at the jobs, job board, they don't have anything right now. I'm trying to figure out, see if I can get a sense more of sort of what their road is. But yeah, so you know, it's a new business division. I think they're still trying to figure. I think they have some ideas on where they want to go based on what I've read and what I've heard. But more along the way of how can this Elsevier is doing it under their own banner, right? Got these research products around their own data sets and things like
I see.
So you know, as I said, we are pretty near the beginning, and part of their goal is, so they've brought people in from different teams, from different backgrounds, to try and see, to try and basically see what they can do to bring people together, etc. So it's a new, it's a technology division, and I think over time they might even build their own software.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah. That's really nice. Yeah. I must say, I've been using the, speaking of apps, I've been using the New England Biolabs, their iPhone app, right? I mean, I've been doing a lot of, molecular biology reading or whatever, my experiments as well.
Yeah.
And it's amazingly well done. You know, the Promega one is another app, but it's pretty, I don't know, it's not as good as the NEB one. And that's when I mean, we've talked about iPhone apps, but I think in terms of usability, you know, other than papers, which is amazing, but there's not that many things that I'm aware of, at least, that, you know, you can use. But yeah, it'll be nice to see what these guys come up with. So that's Caitlin Thaney, you said, is part of BD for that?
She's responsible for external partnerships.
I see. Oh, that's cool. Nice.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. So I totally, yes, I've sort of been a little bit out of touch with the rest of the world lately. So, I mean, I know Elsevier is doing a bunch of things. I know Macmillan is doing some interesting things. At some point of time, I'll get around all of, put my head around all of this and try and figure out, you know, what everything is, how they're doing it, what the value props for various things are. But yeah, my level of knowledge right now is mostly what I see from Caitlin's tweets and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, what I like about digital science is the people behind it more than anything
else. Right. No, I mean, NPG has done phenomenal stuff under Timo Hamani. Yeah. Right?
And, you know, that was all Timo's thing. And, you know, knowing Caitlin, it's not something that would be done if it didn't have some good intentions behind it. So, so I'm definitely very interested to see where it goes.
Ooh.
Go ahead.
Also, I don't know, it's not on our story list, but I heard Nodal Point.
Did we ever talk about this?
I don't think so, because I heard it after our last recording. So
yeah, I think it's because there were two episodes so far away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of, and we haven't been recording in such a long time. I think I think we should call out the fact that Nodal Point has a podcast now.
Yeah, I'm just looking. Oh, there's only been one episode, right?
Two. I think
there's a second one. See, I lost my iPhone, so it's like totally.
So I won't say Nodal Point has a podcast. Nodal Point is a podcast.
Right.
Now.
Oh, they interviewed Pedro in episode two. So episode one is the one I heard. In which they were interviewing Neil Saunders.
Yeah.
And it is a really nice podcast, actually. And I think, you know, it's a nice, an ecosystem of two podcasts now, which cater to bioinformatics.
I am so glad. And this is great because, you know, we can do our bantery, chattery thing. Yeah, and
random rambles through.
But having Greg and talk to various people who are doing real science, I mean, I think we've always talked about it. But as you can guess, I mean, I think Greg does these. It's tough to do this regularly if you want to make it an interview show with our schedules.
Right.
But absolutely. In fact, I'm looking at the Nodal Point page, and I guess we should have add Nodal Point to any blog roles we have, if we have any. But he's got something called the Self-Rest podcast along with us and Futures in Biotech. Are you familiar with that podcast?
Is this Cells podcast? No, I haven't heard.
Yeah,
that
it's one. Cells podcast in IT, and it's pretty hardcore.
Really?
Huh. it's kind of like,
you know, Nature. I used to hear the Nature podcast in the first year.
Yeah.
Then they switched the person who produces it. Right? It went from I don't know who. They switched producers, and then after that, I just got so used to listening to the old voices that I never went back in.
Isn't Adam Rutherford still involved, or did he switch from being producer to actually being one of the narrators?
Actually, I think it switched to Adam Rutherford. The people who...
Yeah, he used to be the producer right. when I met him yeah. first.
So it was... the people who did the Naked Science podcast, they used to do
yeah.
the first many episodes. And then it switched to Adam okay. Rutherford. And I mean, it's just one of those things that, you know, I just moved focus yeah. to listening to other stuff. And I read my magazine, but I don't listen to the yeah. podcast much. But yeah. no, and then my at that time, I checked out the Science Magazine podcast. And it was very, very heavy. I mean, it was very yeah, heavy very. That, you know, I mean, I guess it's hard to strike a balance between two kind of general and two sciencey, but yeah. the NPG's niche podcast did it perfectly. And they still do. Yeah. I mean, every once in a while,
they still do a great right. job. My biggest problem with the Nature podcast is they don't have any description at the podcast level. So when you see it in iTunes, it just shows up as podcast number so-and-so.
Yeah.
So I have no idea what they're talking mm-hmm. about. If they, you know, that's why I'm like, oh, do I have to listen to a whole podcast mm-hmm. and listen to things that are interesting but not so interesting to me kind of thing. So so I listen to it randomly. The sort of science-y, although it's not pure science, it's kind of eclectic podcast that I listen to a lot these days. There's something called Radiolab.
Oh, wow. Actually, my... Chris Miller, my ex-boss's, his daughter works for Radiolab. It's awesomely yeah. produced, right? It's out of New York,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, fabulous. Yeah, it's out of correct. New York. It's very professional, right. but it's just great.
Yeah. A lot of people I know listen to it and they love it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's very well done. They have a good sense of humor. They have, you know, it's society, it's culture, it's mm-hmm. science. It'd be good. I mean, it'd be kind of funny if something like the MythBusters or somebody had a had a podcast as well. But I really like Radiolab.
Mm.
It's very well done. They like recently had a podcast that I was listening to, which was maybe it's not so recent. My memory is kind of funky these days. With like Kevin Kelly and a few other people about, you know, things like the singularity and Kevin's Kelly stuff. It was really interesting, and they were like asking really challenging questions. Mm-hmm. So it's good. If I had to tell somebody to pick up one new podcast, that's the one I would recommend.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I just need my commute's too short now. That's the problem.
Yeah. You know what I do now? Morning while I'm getting ready, Apple TV. I never watched video podcasts before,
mm-hmm.
but now I do. So because I can turn all the, because that's my 1 hour in the morning instead of turning on the television, which I don't turn goodness, on. I yeah. just turn on the Apple TV mm-hmm. and watch some podcast of some video podcast. It could be a CNN thing, it could be an Economist thing, it could
nice.
Be a techie thing.
That too, actually.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It works out quite well. Anyway, we haven't really started talking about anything useful.
Well, yet. If you want useful things, please listen to the Nodal Point podcast from this one. I'm just yeah. kidding. But
yeah.
All
we are missing is alcohol and weed.
I know. Maybe we should simulate like have like liquid pouring in glasses and stuff so people think we're drinking. Yeah. No.
Yeah, I can probably do that if I wanted to. Already, talking about where do you want to start? Let's start off by with something that we actually talked about last podcast, which is when we talked about the Arsenic Life story and how they had, you know, the authors were not doing a good job of responding to blog posts and things like that. And there's a really interesting... there's a good article in Nature, or Nature News, called Peer Review Trial by Twitter. Mm. I thought it would be about the Arsenic Life thing, but it's actually about something else. It's about GWAS. So similar idea, different story. So last year, there was a Wall Street headline story sometime in July last year, apparently, which said scientists discover keys to long life. And there was an NPR story, et cetera. And so there was a paper in Science because somebody had identified genes with human longevity, blah, blah, blah. And apparently there was I don't remember what I was doing in July, but apparently there was a blog and Twitter firestorm about that paper. And, there was, as somebody says, David Goldstein at Duke said, basically anybody that does a lot of GWAS knows this pitfall, which is why we all responded so quickly, because they were particularly unhappy that the 100-year-old people and the controls mm-hmm. had been done with different kinds of chips.
Mm.
And you know that chip to chip, there's no stability at that time. right? There was no statistical.
I see. So this was a study where they compared people who lived to be 100, right? And
And they're and I guess they use different underlying chip technologies for control versus actual cohort and things like that. It's an interesting article. I won't go into the whole article. We talked about this last time, about preprints, about Twitter, about blogs, and the fact that you don't have to wait for a formal paper rebuttal, or you don't have to wait for a conference where you can get up and challenge somebody's findings. You can challenge them on a blog post. And there's nothing wrong with that. And first of all, you can't stop anybody from doing that. You can't ignore it. And the question becomes, and of course, it could go completely the wrong way too, right? And the point of the article is that we are at a place where people who are publishing science and universities that are, or researchers are promoting a particular story, you know, by getting it's in the Wall Street Journal and things like that, have to think about how the community is going to respond and where they're going to respond, because they're not going to respond in just the standard places that you're used to, you know, post-publication peer review, as they call it.
Right. No, you know, the one question I have, right, I mean, is that, come on, it's almost impossible to track feedback associated with your paper because, you know, nobody has a standard citation system. So, you know, that is my gut reaction to this. I'm like, okay, I've never seen anything on Twitter. You know, I mean, there's general chatter. I guess, you're right. If it gets picked up by mainstream media, then it's big then. Then, obviously, at that point, it's fair game. But otherwise, it's so hard to get feedback on anything from any of these systems. So,
I think, personally, to some extent, Twitter is just a signal, right? It's just saying that there's a discussion around it. You can't really go into...
Correct. Well, unless there's a hashtag or something, right? I mean...
Yeah. But, you know, I think this is where this... I believe there was a conference going on last week called Beyond the PDF. Mm-hmm. Which is where they discussed a lot of these things. So Cameron, for example, Nalen, is submitting a proposal to build an altmetrics framework infrastructure where you're... And I think definitely, if you have a PubMed page or if you have a paper page and you're capturing links and you're tracking them, that's one part. I think it has to be a mix of... It is somebody's responsibility to figure out where the conversation is happening.
Mm.
Or at least somebody should try and figure out how to do it. As long as you're exposing some kind of link or metadata.
I mean, forget science, right? I mean, people have failed to do that even in the general social network sphere, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very, very hard problem. Right. Yeah. But on the other hand, I think there are some mechanisms in the sciences because your volume is still relatively low compared to, you know, you're not talking 20,000 responses. You're talking 500 in most cases. Mm. Be able to capture that. And I used to not be a huge fan of the whole quote-unquote research blogging concept where they were putting in this little bit of metadata saying I'm talking about this paper and the researchblogging.org people were bringing it all together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people like Mendeley who are capturing paper information, people like Zotero, who are the guys who give out the DOIs, those guys, they can start capturing a lot of what Bitly does essentially with short links. Yeah, and start doing it. And, you know, Bitly and all are being very used and they earn a lot of money from doing that.
So there is no, other than the DOIs, right? There is no...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it'll be... A lot of people do put DOIs, so I guess it's just possible to...
Yeah, so it'll be one of two things. You have to either cache links to the original source or to a DOI. So PubMed should count.
Correct.
Right, a link to PubMed should come. Yeah. Yes, you'll miss a bunch of things, but my guess is that a significant number of people, and I think you can come up with some community rules around it. Right, whenever you're referring to a paper,
the DOIs were pretty popular, right? I mean, people would always put the DOI for the paper, so that research.
Yeah, they still do that. I think people who discuss, like Ido Friedberg Rosie Redfield, they'll always do it. Whenever I talk about a formal paper, I'll always have a link to it. Also, there's things like, what's his name, Bosco Ho.
Yeah.
Has done something very interesting. He's got a Google App Engine app where he takes abstract from PubMed or HubMed actually, And he's got discuss conversations. It's called Annotator. Mm-hmm. Annotator.appspot.com, A-N-N-O-T-A-T-R, mm-hmm. I think, or something like that. And you can have conversations on papers as a discuss conversation,
mm-hmm.
right? And we actually have a journal club going right now where we do that, where we discuss papers in structural biology and molecular dynamics.
You have a journal club going at Amazon or...?
No. This is something that... so if you go to annotator.appspot.com, mm-hmm. You'll see... it's a mashup of Cite You Like and Discuss.
Oh, cool. Nice. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so if you go to the... So there's a search thing there. There's recent searches. Then if you look at the recent comments, RRS, mm-hmm. you click on the community-wide assessment of GPCR structure modeling and ligand docking. It'll take you to that abstract, and just look below that. There's a whole discussion around the paper.
That's cool. Yeah. No, I can't. Yeah, we should put the link in the show notes. So
yeah.
Take a look.
So absolutely. I mean, the things like this are what's going to be interesting, right? These mashing up things like... That's why I think people like Mendeley, Cite You Like, people who have a lot of information on what people are looking at, or even... I keep forgetting the name of the org that does the DOIs. Those guys...
JSTOR, isn't it JSTOR?
No, not JSTOR. JSTOR is the library. They're the core organization that does DOIs. I'm trying to find mm-hmm. it. I'm sure it's mentioned in the article somewhere, but I can't quite catch it.
Isn't JSTOR?
JSTOR is like a library software, right?
JSTOR is it connects libraries and all the stuff, right? But
yeah, so it scans journals, right, and things like that.
But it's all free and, well, I don't know, I'm scared to use the word open, but it's all free access stuff, right?
Yeah, so DOIs are a property of the DOI Foundation. I'm trying to see who else, somebody does the DOIs. I met the people also. Anyway, you and Addy would be able to tell us because international DOIs, membership, anyway. Whoever it is, divide or all. There's people who do that.
Mm-hmm.
And Crossref, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. Crossref.org.
Mm.
You know, they're meant for cross-referencing, I mean, as the name suggests. Basically, it goes back to your references have to include what I've always felt like. If you are going to PubMed, you know, you get additional information papers that cite it. You should get a list of, like, because then relevance becomes important. This is why folks like... you know, Mendeley or someone who's doing a lot of Hadoop stuff and doing a lot of data analytics. So they have they can have relevance algorithms that help you say, okay, here are the 10 posts that have been cited the most discussing this paper mm-hmm. or tweeted about the most and things like that. I think that's, I'm not saying it's going to take a while to figure out how to do it, but I think there is a role for it. And I think it'll be really useful if we do it the right way. It could just become a sham, which is also very easy to do, but easier to do. But I think there's a value, and I think a lot of these people who provide citation bookmarking services or citation management services, I would love to know who's talking about a paper that I have in my library and what's mm-hmm. the discussion around it, things like that. So anyway, I think, you know, it was just a follow-up of something we talked about last week. I think it's going to be a very interesting
I like the quote by Jonathan Eisen in that article where he's like, who in the world would want to log into the Plus One website only to post a comment on a paper? It's just so much easier to just do it on Twitter, you know, and I totally agree.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I wanted to talk about, sort of moving on from that one, I'm sort of jumping our Google Doc here, is Titus Brown's 10 Principles of Computational Science article. I thought you'd appreciate that. So Titus is, he's a Pythonista, I think. Mm-hmm. So you'll probably run into him in that context. I got to know him, basically he's got a really nice blog. I got to know him at work because he teaches his Next Generation Sequencing workshop on EC2. And wrote a really nice blog post about it, etc. And we are both now on the editorial board of Open Computation Research. What he's basically, he posted this in December, so it's an older blog post. It's been sitting in my Insta paper queue for a while. Where he talks about, you know, he says, I just finished teaching my computational science for evolutionary biologists course, And he's finding it tricky to come up with a high-level summary of what he would like them to take away. So he came up with a set of principles of computational science. And what are the principles that they should apply as they do what he considers computational science? And he's, as he says, these are some principles and by no means comprehensive. But I just wanted to, as you know, as somebody who's interested in computational science, I just wanted to see what your take would be as you go through those. And we don't have to go through them one by one. But I found some of these ideas really interesting. You know, right from the beginning, for example, he starts off, and actually I like that the most. He says, computational science is just like any other science. Don't trust it if you don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a problem a lot of non-computational people who do computation end up with. They either treat it like a complete black box and hope what they get out means something. So they aren't doing... So I've seen this happen before, where they're not doing the necessary cross-checks or validation. If you're doing an experiment in lab, you would validate it because you don't trust your own experiment, right? People don't do that.
Software is always a black box, right? I mean, it's insert software here, get result there.
Yeah.
So
people don't do controls. You should have, like, I remember when I was developing some new method or using some new version of software, the first thing I would do is run it against a known benchmark.
Mm-hmm. I'll generally use the tutorial, you know, just to make sure that it's doing what it says it does. But
yeah, but I don't even go that far. I want to trust it against, I mean, for me, it was because that was all my work. MD, right? I was publishing on it. I wanted to be sure that I understood the results and if there was any discrepancies against data that I knew was right. You know, either there were some standard benchmarks that you could run against, but some that I knew well. You would always do that. And I find that a lot of people doing computation who are not computational people don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
They just assume it's right or they assume it's wrong, one of the two. they don't try and validate or have some kind of controls in place. And that's somewhat troubling, I think. But I think that's true. And then the moment you make things a black box, even if the source code was available, you can't expect somebody who is not a computational person who may not understand the language to go read the algos and see how the source code works. Right. That's ridiculous. Yeah, that's for the community who are actually working on the algos. So things like that.
I like the, if it's not automated, it's crap.
Yeah, that's the one I was going to talk about. I love that.
No, and I agree, you know, it's like, so the statement goes, if it's not automated, it's crap. As soon as there's some manual step in your pipeline, you've lost track of what you're doing. You may do differently or not at all or incorrectly, and you'll never, ever know. You'll just get different results sometimes.
Yep.
And that's true, you know, it's like only if you standardize can you automate. And when you standardization is a very good thing because it improves your efficiency and improves the way you think about a problem. It's, you know, it's a very, that's why I like writing, you know, writing silly scripts that do the same thing over and over again, because it forces me, you know, it's like simple things like always starting a file name with the date and then an underscore. So then I'm like, I'm thinking 10 steps ahead. I'm like, okay, one day if I want to look at all these files, I know I'm consistent, you know, in the naming of the file. Something as silly as that. So,
One reason I believe, and I'm hardly somebody to say this these days, but one reason I believe that everyone who works on computers should know some scripting is exactly that.
Right, yeah. You're thinking in terms of how do you automate. You know, like a silly example, right? Like I kept getting information from, you know, a bunch of sources which had important IDs, like numerical IDs buried as in GIFs, right? Because they were snapshotting, you know, a spreadsheet or something and sending it to me. And I actually went and said, you know, hey, in the future, I'd really like it that you snapshot it and send it to me, but it's so much easier for you. But once you do that, it's lost to me because I use, you know, text search to find everything. And the best way to lose me is by making sure that, you know, if my text search doesn't catch it, very often to me, it doesn't exist. You know, something as silly as that. Right? And then the person was really nice. He's like, you know, I never thought about that. To me, I was sending you the information, but clearly to you, only if it's text, it's meaningful. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Because I automate even the reading of, I mean, not, I don't automate the reading of my email, but, you know, it's something silly as I use, you know, grep like every other day to find stuff, you know, so.
Yes. Grep is one of the single best. Grep and cat.
No, and there's, yeah, I like this, you know, there's like, it's really a very, what do you call, true to the bones description of this stuff, right? Computation is not science, is number 7. Science is science. Computation may be one of the ways in which you do science, which is true, absolutely, yes. You know. Like, it's like, I hate the term, like, oh, I write software, right? It's like, no, I mean, I do science. It just so happens I write software to do that, so, I mean, to do some part of that science, but...
That's why I differentiate computational biologists and informaticians from software engineers.
Right.
I think it could be the same person wearing different hats.
Mm-hmm.
But those are 3 different activities. Writing software, you can write software to get your computation done.
Right.
You can write software which is designed to be what I call infrastructure software, which helps other people do science better, or yourself. And then there's the analytics, the statistical software, where your software is just a representation of the kind of algorithms that you want to write. Except that the only way a computer can understand it is code, right? So, you know, it's a language that you have to speak instead of... you know, the analogy I use is your algorithm doing that is like, how are you making a buffer? You know, there's the method that your buffers are made and so on. So absolutely. I actually think number 8 is just general. You know, if you look at it, it's virtually impossible to analyze data with some kind of hypothesis in mind. I think this is the part that a lot of people forget. And this sort of goes back to number 9 as well. Which is that more data is not necessarily less confusing. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the problem that people have is that they just generate data and they forget about the why they're generating data. It's okay to not think about it when you're generating it, but before you look at it, you must know why.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's some of the knocks about, you know, systems biology that I have, right? It's open-ended questions are awesome, but, you know...
You've seen my last blog post, right? You like it?
Oh, yeah? Okay.
My last blog post was about incremental science, or 2 blog posts ago. It came, so I won't talk about it in detail, the private dinner that I went to, and people were talking a lot about large, very, very difficult biological problems, but they invited a lot of technology people, folks from Amazon, Microsoft, Google, that kind of people, because they have solved tough engineering problems. And what jumped out at me was that it's fine solving all those problems, but what we really need are structures in place, infrastructurally and platform-wise, that allows, you know, the individual lab to sort of chip away at these problems. Because there's 2 ways to solving. Is that there's a lot of little things that we end up doing in small labs that we shouldn't do, which means that you don't have time to solve the hard problems, or you don't have time to go higher up the stack. You go end up becoming really slow and inefficient. And sometimes the only way to get to the big answer is one step at a time, right? Science doesn't always happen overnight. It's you build on top of what somebody else has done and you take it to the next level. And it struck out at me was that we should never forget that. Although it's fine to solve some really, really hard problems, and, you know, some places, you know, there are some people who live on that and fine. And it's a good thing. You need people like that. Otherwise, you'd never split the atom and fun stuff like that. But even then, I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that a lot of the problems get solved by solving part of a bigger picture, and then you're putting the puzzle together, essentially. But that, to me, that's what a lot of science is. You have you are working on a puzzle and you're closing pieces of the puzzle, and the more pieces you close, the easier it gets to fill it up. And you need to make it easier to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. No, I think, I mean, while I like the concept of data generation, I love it. But I think people forget the fact that it's not just about generating a lot of data. It's also about taking slices at what you do with it. And so, yeah. No, that was very interesting.
Speaking of these general points, I finally looked at, you know, the software carpentry.
This Greg Wilson's.
Yeah, I'd heard about it. I think Chris Lasher had done some screencasts for
Chris. Chris and Cameron are both big fans.
Right, yeah, I finally saw it, and, you know, it's all video lectures now. It used to be, I guess, they are still actual courses that he organizes, but now all of the, there's several screencasts that, so each lecture now is now video shared for free, so you can pretty much go and watch
that's cool.
So, I mean, at least I saw a couple of them. I'm imagining all of them are free, but yeah, it's really... Yeah. You know, it's so important that, I think it's cool, this whole movement to, you know, basic tools like version control and knowing the shell and, you know, knowing your one editor well and, you know, very basic things are, can go such a long way. So, yeah.
I mean, to us, they might seem like, oh, why not? You know, why this just seems normal. But
no, it's not, right? But yeah, I think, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you see people, as this guy says, right, do repeated tasks manually, and you just think it's criminal. You know, it's such a waste of time, and it's wrong for a person to have to do this repeatedly manually. And knowing the tools well just ensures that you never ever have to do that. You know, and yeah, that's one thing. I mean, this year I kind of started to really use only one or two things and use them everywhere. Like, I started using Emacs because I code a lot now on Linux as well. And I like TextMate a lot. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, TextMate is like very Emacs-y in my mind.
So, but now, you know, I figured that I should really use only one editor so I get really good at it.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I still type slowly, so my productivity is not that good. But knowing Emacs just makes me feel like, just think of a problem so much better, you know, like, it's made a big difference knowing the tool well to writing code quicker, you know, like jumping to functions with one keyboard shortcut is phenomenal. I mean, before I would scroll back and forth and, you know, as somebody said, the maniacal obsession with productivity that is behind Emacs as engineering is so important in other aspects of anything, right? So
it took me a long time to stop doing Control X, Control S.
Yeah, and in fact, now it's like, I mean, whenever I use my laptop, I've become so keyed into Emacs that, you know, it's I still do Control X, Control S on my browser window and, you know, stupid things like that.
Yeah, so. No, I used to do that for a long time. I used to do that all the time. And, especially when you're using multiple systems, having a single editor that you know well and you can have the same kind of bindings for it everywhere is really useful. You know, I'm working through this right now. So I have two laptops now, and one's a secondary, one's a primary, but I was trying to build a programming environment on the secondary one, on the Air.
You got the new MacBook Air?
11 Woo! Inch.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, it's great. That's my work machine. So basically, that's what I use at work. It's a limited machine, but you know, having things like something like RVM, like if you're setting up a Ruby environment with gem sets and all that, because you can just basically export and import and use the same ones everywhere, and use tools like Bundler, which make it very easy to have the replicated environment everywhere. And in fact, my link of the week also points to that. It becomes very important, very useful. Having to do that. It's like I have the standard bash RC file that I use on every machine.
My shell is the same, but yeah, now it's really so nice once you start doing that. And I have like silly scripts that, you know, now I've kind of put them all on GitHub and I move them back and forth. You know? I mean, well, basically GitHub's like my organizer of all this stuff. So it's just really nice.
Yeah, I have a gist with, maybe not a gist, maybe it's a proper repo with where I keep all my Git ignore file.
Nice.
Where I just, what I did was I forked somebody's Git ignore file and do that. But yeah, that's absolutely, I mean, that's the place to do it. I actually use Evernote a lot for things like that as well. Just shove stuff into it. And I'm toying with the idea of one of the things is, you know, nowadays with things like Evernote and Dropbox and all, it's very easy to keep stuff between synced up. But on my work machine, there's stuff that I don't want to take off that work machine. I'm thinking of using something like Yojimbo.
What's Yojimbo? I heard you talk about that.
I've never really used it. Like Matt Wood used to swear by it. I don't know if he still does. It's kind of this app
It's a OS X thing.
It's a Mac only thing. Where you basically throw stuff at it, it figures out what that stuff is and organizes it. You just basically dump stuff. You don't have to figure out what it is, and it just understands. You just stash information. So text, images, serial numbers, passwords. So I have other things that do it, so I've not really gone in that direction. You know, because I use like 1Password. I'm more of a best tool for a task kind of person. But it's interesting. The reason I've never used it is I never felt a need. But if I have a system where I don't want that data to leave that system, maybe it's worth using. I don't know. We'll see. It goes back to automation and workflow, right? Where you basically don't want to take manual decisions. Mm-hmm. Something is, you've made your decision earlier and you're just throwing stuff at it. Which actually brings us to the next thing I wanted to talk about. And this is that beyond the PDF thing that I put out, research objects of the future. That's something that Martin Fenner sent my way. Yeah. And this was discussed at Beyond the PDF.
At the UCSD, and, right? It is a workshop on the 19th to 21st of Jan.
Yeah, that just finished. You know, Martin was there, Cameron was there, Caitlin was there. People we know were there. And they were talking about a research object thing, which is kind of a cross between... the way it was described to me, and we're having this discussion, it's like Dropbox at one side. So you have something that you can take all the data in. You have some kind of metadata store which understands what the data is. So you know it's a text PDF, what's the metadata associated with it, and making it available to share with people. And so what's the structure? So you know you can type into an institute. You can sort of jump, hook into institutional repository and so on. Question is, who builds it and what? How, what would it look? So they've thrown out some ideas on what it would look like, etc. It's pretty involved, so I won't talk about it in too much detail, but it's a very interesting idea. So for example, sub-projects in that could be packaging data formats, infrastructure. They're thinking of using EPUB as their interchange format, for example. So
nice. So it's basically like... And ideas to come up with standards, I guess, right? For all this stuff.
I don't think it's necessary to come up with standards. Just I think because once you start going into standards, you're screwed. That you'll be doing this 4 years from now and not have anything practical. I think it's more of a case of building tools, you know, and letting, maybe having a few competitive ones and letting the community agree on something.
You know, a slight aside to this, but... It's amazing how much better information dissemination is in terms of, you know, how much better the engineering of XPASY, NCBI, like all their the PDB, all their new. So I've been doing a lot of like data gathering, and in the last 2 years, I mean, I think the charge was led in some ways by XPASY and all, but now they're all so much better than they were 2 years back.
PDB has got some really neat features.
I mean, like, to give you an example, I mean, the reason I kind of went off on this tangent is I was just looking at this, you know, the nano publication draft that they have, right? You know, it's just a way to at least write down how they want to, like, share information better, right? But, you know, things like, so the PDB, right? They have a simple feature where if you have like 50 PDB entries, there was an automatic, like it'll automatically dump that to Excel or CSV or something, right? And not only everything, like REST is so permeated into all aspects of, you know, the engineering of these sites. It's so trivial to automate stuff, you know? So the other day,
I'm here. I can hear you, although your volume suddenly changed.
I hit my mic, so... Okay. anyway, so long aside, it's just funny how much better NCBI, XPASY, but XPASY always was incredible. UniProt, you know, all of them.
Yeah, always. From the days of, what do they call, OpenView or... You know, they used to have this engine that they had developed some years when I was using it, like this is 10 years ago, was miles ahead of everybody else.
And now, I mean, I really felt very happy when the other day I was actually, and PubChem, right? PubChem is phenomenal. Like, have you used the PubChem editor?
I haven't. But
the other day I was stuck on some machine that I didn't have a proprietary application to draw out a structure on. And
yeah, so they have a JavaScript editor or something?
It's actually, it's not even JavaScript. It's okay, it's JavaScript, but the actual, it's a client-server platform. So this is a total aside, yeah. Apologies. So you know how the PubChem editor works? There's a chemical informatics paper on it. So the actual editor UI is just a JavaScript catcher. So every time you drag a bond, it sends an event back to the server, figures out what the bond should look like, and comes back with a PNG, right? So the whole server, I mean, basically the software on the front end is just like a canvas of buttons, right? And GUI elements. Yeah. And it actually runs as performant as a desktop or a full JavaScript app, right? I mean, it's incredible. Yeah. And I was just thinking about this. I never need to have a desktop software anymore. I totally get it, you know?
Yeah.
And so now I started using that for everything because by the time I wait for my... I mean, of course, performance is still going to be better for client software. But once I learn this interface inside out, I don't ever have to... The engineering of it is just so neat. And the fact that it is free like and web, out there for PubChem to use... Like, I wouldn't look for a particular compound, but I wasn't sure of the IUPAC name. In 2 seconds, like, I drew it up, got the IUPAC name, and I was looking for it in Sigma and everywhere, you know? And it's like, wow, engineering is really starting to seep into these things, and it's very heartening. I don't know. I felt very happy about
it. Actually, with JavaScript and things like WebGL and back server-side acceleration becoming really important. So you have that. You have web, you know, Rich Apodaca has got a really good blog post on WebGL. And if you ever use his ChemWriter software, that's also really good. You know, things like that. So these are very, you know, JavaScript engines. What's his name? Bosco is working on JMOL or something like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, JavaScript.
So, I mean,
JMOL editor, I think I've used that one too. But.
I don't think it's JMOL. It's because JMOL is an applet.
JavaMOL is the applet.
Yeah, so I'm trying to Bosco. I actually should just go to his webpage. Trapped in the USA.
I was doing this search, right? So just to give you what... I was trying to find a search.
It's called Jolly Q.
Oh, okay, I haven't used that one. I was trying to find all PDB structures with a particular ligand substructure, right? So I had to like first learn how to do a substructure query, which I knew. Then I had to figure out if the PDB would actually tolerate and run a substructure query against all its ligands. And one Google search later, the PDB has this thing called Ligand Depot, and it had its own editor, like it is like a PubChem-like editor. I could draw a ligand, right? It would automatically give me the smiles, and if I hit go, it would do a substructure search against the PDB and pull out all structures in the PDB cross-referenced with PubChem and the PDB. And it literally took me like 20 minutes to generate information, which I thought would take me a day. You know, it was phenomenal. And that's when I said, wow. And at one point, I wanted to make a spreadsheet with all the structure images. And I was like, okay, I bet you this is going to take like 20 clicks with my mouse to download every image, right? But then I realized that REST was in there and all the images were basically a standard REST call. So it was like, you know, rcsb.org/ligand/2vss_200.gif, right? That gave me a 200 by 200 pixel image of that. So one Python script, 2 lines later, I had all the scripts wget-ed and saved and in a CSV. It was so phenomenal to be able to do that. And that's when you're like, you know, I remember even 3 years back, that wasn't the case. Like there was no standardization, right?
Yeah. So if you can write the moment you can start using curl or wget to get stuff, you solved half your problem. I'm actually I'd heard about this, but I haven't seen it before. But if you go to PDB and you do a search, so I did a search for bacterial adoption, it's got faceted search now. So it gives you query refinements.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think I've...
Organism, taxonomy, experimental method, X-ray.
Oh, yeah. They've been doing this for a while.
No, I think I saw a post on it like recently. I think they've basically improved the drill down mechanisms.
Organism, that's been there for a while now.
It's really well implemented also.
And you know, if you click on any one of them, it even gives you like, you can like get all of them like as a spreadsheet. And it's like very, very powerful. And
or generate reports,
right,
generate
reports
like
on the fly, right? It's really nice. And you know, literally a lot of this has been not more than a year and a half old.
How much do you think Phil Bourne has to do with all of this? At least at the
I'm sure. I mean, it's the thinking, right? I mean, it's. I think it's finally, like, engineering at this level in Google and all these big guys, right? The fact that they've done such a phenomenal job with organizing that information, I think it's trickling down to every aspect of,
yeah,
you know.
I'm
glad
to
seriously,
see that.
I mean, I've been using the PDB every day for years, right? I think it's only, like, in the last couple of years,
4 years back, it
right?
Used to suck.
I mean, it was very bad. I mean, you know, speaking again, another tangent is, so the other day I was using the NCBI for finding some information, and on the right was an embedded screencast on how to use that feature. And
the YouTube
channel of NCBI is phenomenal. It's called like NCBI NLM or something. But I was like, you know, it took them.
Yeah, I actually subscribed to it.
Right, it took them how long to embed a screencast on the page, right? So that you can learn how to use the feature right away. But it's cool. It's nice.
Yeah, no, it's good. I have to say, I think the Europeans started it, but it's good to see everyone now, you know, the ensembles and the uniprots and all that did a really good job. But, you know, and it goes back to all of this. Once you have the data resources, once you have the APIs, it just makes everybody's life so much easier. Yeah. So why don't we? We've been talking for almost an hour. Okay. So why don't we call it a day? Why don't? Before we do that, do you have a link of
actually,
the week?
I had one, but let me go ahead first. There's one thing I said. I should.
So we were talking about automation and reusability, etc. The tool that I would like to talk about is Vagrant. For anybody.
Okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever used it.
No, go ahead. I'll tell you.
It is simply amazing. Just all I will say is, even if you don't use Ruby, download VirtualBox, install Vagrant, and play with it. It is stunningly
frank
beautiful.
Confession. So remember last episode, I talked about how I heard Jacob Kaplan-Moss talk about Chef, right? And how he gave this cool talk about everything. Everyone is DevOps, right? DevOps is... And he said how he spends all his time writing Ruby code. And I said, okay, if it's good enough for the creator of Django, let me look at what Chef is. But 2 seconds after that, there was someone on FriendFeed that posted about Vagrant.
Probably me or actually EMP.
There's a few of us who are big Vagrant
it wasn't,
fans. I mean, if it was you, I would have treated it with my traditional Ruby, anti-Ruby filter. But no, I have nothing against Ruby. But I literally, so I was writing this multi-threaded code in Python and it wasn't working. It was working on OS X, but it wasn't working on Ubuntu, right? And I said, you know what, let me give Vagrant a try. Within like 10 minutes, I had a 500 MB super small, right? Vagrant instance running on my Mac. And I was basically, I had a full Ubuntu environment in like 5 minutes, right? It was so cool. And the only problem is, I guess VirtualBox doesn't support cross CPU virtualization, so I couldn't virtualize 64-bit on a 32-bit. Yeah. But Vagrant was amazing. And that is when I said, you know what? When I have free time, I'm going to make a Vagrant, Vagrant file of all the software I use. And just take it on a USB stick with me because this is sheer power. No, that's a huge...
No, Vagrant is amazing and it has full Chef integration in it.
Right. So, yeah, I don't know much about Chef, but yeah, I use Vagrant to like, you know, start up two different flavors of Ubuntu and BSD or something to test some code. And it took me barely any time. And
the best part is it's all controlled. You don't have to spin up
Hashimoto, right? What's his name?
Yeah, Mitchell Hashimoto. He's at University of Washington.
Yeah, Mitchell Hashimoto. And I'm on the Vagrant list, and I've been like posting there whenever I had a problem and stuff. That's a cool...
Excellent.
And by the way, frank admission, I also started looking at Ruby. After Jacob Kaplan-Moss's talk, I was like, hey, you know, how hard can Ruby be? So
I think, I actually think if you're if you are into data analysis and stuff like that, you end up being... If you're really, and if that's what you do, you end up being like you end up being like something like Pete Smoroch and do both. No, where you do your statistics and you do your numerical analysis in Python, and you do things like, because this is where Ruby really shines, like provisioning and
that whole Ruby really shines in terms of community and deployment and all these things, right?
Yeah.
It's really, I mean, and the cloud. I think in terms of the cloud, Ruby.
You should check. Yeah, if you ever try Ruby, there's this thing called Fog. Mm-hmm. Fog comes out of Engine Yard and it's actually integrated. So if you use Knife in Chef. Chef has this command line tool called Knife to launch servers on EC2. It actually uses Fog underneath the hood. Engineer just funded Mitchell to take Vagrant and move it to have it a version of Vagrant that supports VMware Fusion, Vagrant that supports Parallels and things like that.
It's amazing how the amount of power that you have. It was all free. I mean, you know, VirtualBox is free.
Yeah, it's
and
all.
The
it's
API
all free.
Was so cool that you can, like, I had like three different OSs running. And I mean, the people who bundled these they're really tiny, right? FindMV was a full Ubuntu instance. And
yeah, and the reason I like the Chef integration is I haven't done it yet, but with Chef integration and Vagrant, and I think there'll be more work on this in the future, going from your desktop to a fleet of servers somewhere in the planet, you know, launching a bunch of EC2 instances should be just the same gem should be able to do both, or it should be just a little Chef script that does that. And you can imagine how quickly all of these things get automated. Yeah, so I've been playing with Vagrant. I really, really like it. My other option was RVM, which I also like a lot, but I'll stop here.
Nice. All right. Actually, my link of the week was going to be Software Carpentry, but I figured that since we did talk about that, the other link of the week, the link of the week I want to put up is actually PubChem's advanced search page and the Sketcher. And the article which talks about, I mean, they're all bundled together. The engineering of the PubChem Sketcher was eye-opening in the way it's put together. It's really, really elegant. So that's my link of the week. I mean, it's so well implemented, and it's like bug free, right? Because everything is server side in some ways, and the performance is really good. I mean, on broadband, you'd never feel like you're not on a client app, you know. So that's my link of the week, the PubChem Sketcher. So I'll send you the link.
Yeah, looking forward to it. No, great, and I'm glad we got to record this week, and hopefully we'll be better. We probably won't record every week just because we are all crazy busy, but hopefully we'll try and do it more often than we did towards the second half of last year.
Absolutely.
So with that, another C2C bio is
another episode of Coast to Coast Bio has coasted, right?
Ah, yes. Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.